The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, the biggest T-Rex to ever live may be bigger than previously thought. Several Northeast communities experienced record dryness this fall, and a private New York college is becoming a university. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. The largest Tyrannosaurus rex to have ever lived may have been much larger than any fossilized specimen ever discovered. A new study from paleontologists Jordan Mallon from the Canadian Museum of Nature and David Hone from Queen Mary University of London asks the question, how big was the biggest T-Rex? To learn more, I asked Dr. Mallon about his research and how perceptions of the popular dinosaur have changed.
You know, certainly our image of T-Rex has changed over the years. We've known about it since, I think, 1905. And when we first found it, it was reconstructed as, you know, standing upright on two legs, as we continue to reconstruct it today. But in the early days, we reconstructed it with its tail dragging on the ground, and it would wander around as a bit of a loner and maybe attacking a triceratops here and there. But our image of T-Rex today is a lot more dynamic. The tail's been lifted off the ground. And even we're starting to think that even some of our older depictions as far as T-Rex, for example, having a scaly body covering might be wrong. There is some evidence to suggest that T-Rex might have had feathers of some kind. Almost certainly it wasn't covered head to toe in feathers, but it might have had a feathery mane or a tuft of feathers here or there across the body, which I think is still a new thought to most people's minds.
Now, how common, when paleontologists like yourself are looking for dinosaur fossils, how common are T-Rex skeletons? I mean, certainly they're one of the most popular dinosaurs, I think, but are they actually any easy to find?
Well, dinosaurs generally aren't easy to find. You know, the fossil record is very patchy and incomplete, and so the likelihood that you're going to go out any one day and find a complete articulated dinosaur skeleton is pretty low. But having said that, of the dinosaurs that we do know, T-Rex is impressively well known. It's represented by around 80 decent specimens. And by decent, I just mean specimens or fossils that we can verifiably identify as T-Rex. They show the classic bony characters that allow us to identify the fossil as T-Rex. You know, 80 is not a bad number. In the early days of looking for T-Rex, it was only known from very few specimens, but there's been a concerted effort in the last two or three decades to look for T-Rex and its contemporaries in places like Montana, and that those dedicated efforts have yielded a lot of fruit.
So your research looked at the size of the Tyrannosaurus rex and estimating the size of the largest T-Rex that ever lived. Why did you want to dig into this and really figure out how big this animal could actually get? What fascinated you about it?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, first, maybe I'll preface my answer by saying boredom. This project sort of came about right as COVID was starting, and so I was forced to work at home and not in the museum collections where I normally pursue my research. So I didn't have access to the fossils that I usually have access to on a day-to-day basis. So I was kind of sitting at home in my basement office wondering, you know, what can I work on now if I don't have fossils in front of me? So one of my colleagues, and he's actually the co-author of the study, David Hone, who's over in the UK, he and I were talking one day, you know, over Zoom, as you do during COVID, and wondering about, you know, we have a good idea as to the average body size of T-Rex, again, given that we've got maybe 80 good specimens now or so, and this includes privately owned specimens, I should add. But there was a study that came out during COVID that suggested that there might have been up to 2.5 billion T-Rex that ever lived on Earth, you know, over a period of a couple million years. And so given that, and given the fact that we've only got a couple dozen examples of T-Rex, what's the likelihood that we've sampled the really biggest ones? We thought that was an interesting question worth asking, and yet nobody had really tackled it before. So that's kind of the opening of the door, as it were.
Well, how big, to start off, I guess, how big is the average size of an adult T-Rex fossil skeleton that scientists have actually discovered?
Yeah, well, first of all, when we're talking about size, there are different ways of measuring body size. So you can measure the length of an animal, you can measure the height of an animal, you can look at the body mass of the animal. That's usually the measurement that most ecologists prefer, body mass, because that really tells you how much of the animal is there. You can have a long, skinny animal or a short, thick animal, and they might have very similar body masses. We estimate the average size of a T-Rex based on the dimensions of the thigh bones, because we know in animals today that the dimensions of the supporting long bones, the thigh bones in bipedal animals and the thigh bones in the humerus, the upper arm bone in quadrupedal animals, these scale really tightly with body mass. So we're able to estimate body mass pretty well in T-Rex, given the dimensions of the leg bones. And the average one was probably on the order of, say, 7,000 kilograms or so, 7 tons. The biggest one that we know of was a little bigger, closer to 9 tons. So, you know, you're talking about a big animal already, probably even larger than the average-sized elephant. You're talking about the size of maybe a large bull male elephant.
And so now, the biggest of the big, T-Rex, if you had to make a comparison between an animal living on Earth now, what would you compare it to?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, the biggest of the big T-Rex, we estimate in our study, would have been probably somewhere on the order of 15,000 kilograms or 15 metric tons. So that's about 70% bigger than the largest T-Rex we know of now. What animal weighs that much? Oh, I'd have to verify. Probably some type of whale, you know? You're talking about a really, really big animal.
Or two elephants, if we could think of it that way, I guess.
Oh, easily two elephants, yeah. Yeah. Two elephants head to tail, certainly.
So, Dr. Mallon, why do you think it's so important for us to continue this research for an animal that went extinct tens of millions of years ago? Why is this so important for understanding our Earth?
Well, I think it's important for a couple of, well, a few different reasons, really. Number one, if T-Rex could reach those largest body sizes, it implies that they, at least the very largest individuals, were capable of, they probably entered a new area of what we call niche space, which is to say that they were consuming different resources than their more average-sized counterparts. So it might be that, you know, a 15,000 kilogram T-Rex could have eaten some of the largest animals in their environment, which were, at least in certain parts of North America, the long-necked sauropod dinosaurs. We don't usually think about T-Rex as having gone after those, you know, the biggest of the big animals, which are largely found during the Jurassic period, but also in the late Cretaceous when T-Rex lived. So we think there are some interesting implications there with respect to the ecology of T. rex. It also has some interesting implications when we think about evolution. There tends to be a trend among animals whereby over evolutionary time, different lineages will reach larger and larger body sizes. This is something that we call Cope's rule, which is to say that in general, there appears to be a selection bias in favor of larger body size. And if you're going to select for those larger body sizes, you want to know what are the largest animals in a population that can be selected for. And in the case of T-Rex, we think the largest of the large were somewhere upwards of 15 metric tons. So that's interesting to know, too, from an evolutionary perspective. And lastly, I think this estimate that we've come up with, 15,000 kilograms, I'll emphasize that it is an estimate. We don't have, you know, fossils, body fossils, showing that these animals existed, but it's really a hypothesis based on our computer modeling that we did. And we can test this idea next, hopefully biomechanically, so we can model these bones in a computer and see whether, you know, the scaled-up bones of a T-Rex were able to bear the weight of such a huge animal. So there's some interesting biomechanical implications there, too, that we're looking forward to seeing others follow up on.
How long do you think it will be until someone finds a specimen that large, at the top of the top, so to speak?
I don't think an animal that big will ever be found. It will be thousands and thousands of years from now, and almost certainly humanity will be extinct by the time. So I don't think we're going to be able to test this idea with the fossil record, given that we're literally talking about one animal in 2.5 billion individuals. So the likelihood that we're going to find that one, and the likelihood that it was even preserved in the fossil record to begin with, is exceedingly small. But we can test it in these other ways, as I say, biomechanically. And so hopefully someone will do that before the next millennium.
Now, have you already gotten any calls from Hollywood about there possibly being an even bigger, badder T-Rex in the next round of films?
Hollywood already tends to portray T-Rex as being bigger than it actually was, at least as far as we know. So they're actually arguably a little ahead of the game, so they don't need to call me.
So where will your research take you next?
Well, I'm working on all kinds of things right now. As I say, I'm interested in questions of dinosaur body size, and questions about sexual dimorphism in dinosaurs, which is to say, are the females bigger than the males, or are the males bigger than the females? So I've always got research on the go relating to that. I'm also very much interested in dinosaur ecology. So I mentioned earlier how body size relates to ecology, and really what drives me is the question about how did dinosaurs get by in life when they were alive? I'm not really interested in how they died and their extinction, but very much interested in what they were like as living, breathing animals. So I've got various projects on the go right now looking at the ecology of large-bodied herbivorous dinosaurs.
Dr. Mallon, thank you so much for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Of course, Lucas. I appreciate the conversation. Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Jordan Mallon from the Canadian Museum of Nature. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Marist College in Poughkeepsie, New York, will become Marist University next year. The State Board of Regents recently approved a motion to grant Marist University status. College President Kevin Weinman says the new name will not result in any major changes for faculty or students, but he hopes it will help Marist better market itself to prospective students and athletes around the world. Weinman spoke about the move with WAMC Hudson Valley Bureau Chief Jesse King.
Marist has come a long way in its 95-year history, particularly over the last 20 or 30 years as we've grown from a small school that used to serve largely the Poughkeepsie region, students from the Poughkeepsie region, many commuter students, to now an institution that draws students from around the country and around the world. We looked at ourselves and said, hey, we've got six colleges and Division I athletics, 50 majors at the undergraduate level, 15 graduate degrees, a doctorate program, a branch campus in Florence. If you just looked at Marist from afar, you'd say, hey, that's a university. And so we've sort of become more like a university than a college over a long period of time. But yet we are really proud to hold on to those roots of a small, we say we act big, but think small in terms of small class sizes and interpersonal interaction between students and faculty. And so we want to retain the very best of what it means to be a college, but also signal to the world that we've arrived as a university.
Tell me a little more about, I guess, that signal. Because, I mean, even regionally, like, Poughkeepsie and the Hudson Valley have a lot of colleges, but not universities.
Yeah, I mean, right now as a college, we worry, there's 4,000 choices students have across the country, right? And some of them who want a university-like experience look at Marist College. We may not get a second look from them, right? Now, by calling ourselves Marist University, they'll say, hey, it's like, let's see what's going on there. Oh, wow, they have all these amazing things that, I thought was only available at a 40,000 person university. And so we do think that this will help us tell our story better. Internationally, the word college means high school or community college. And so trying to appeal to talented international students who would love to come to Marist and we would love to have them here is difficult when we call ourselves a college. So the word university will just signal again who we are to a broader audience, and we're very excited to continue to expand our national and international footprint.
Does this name change anything for students or for faculty at Marist?
Yeah, we've been really clear with really everyone, faculty, students, and alumni who initially might have some hesitancy that the word university might signal things like, hey, are we looking to get a lot bigger? Are we looking to emphasize research over teaching? Are we looking to emphasize graduate programs over undergraduate? The answer is no on all of those things. That really nothing changes. We produced a strategic vision for the future called Marist 100 about a year ago that takes us to and beyond our centennial celebration in a few years. We are not revisiting that plan. Every word still holds here because we're Marist University tomorrow versus Marist College today, does not change our fundamental nature. So we've been able to put a lot of concerned minds at ease that, hey, this is not signaling a drastic new direction. We, of course, always want to be a better Marist, and that's true regardless of what we call ourselves. So we are going to make investments in facilities and individuals and supporting our students and faculty as we go forward. That's all outlined in the strategic vision. But there's nothing about Marist University that suggests that we're a drastically different institution when the name changes.
I guess, how do you view the current landscape for private colleges and universities? It's no secret that here in the state, there have been multiple campuses that have closed in recent years.
Yeah, you're right. And it really started during the pandemic, as we saw a lot of folks step away from higher education, and some of them didn't come back even when the pandemic lifted. So, yes, you are seeing struggling private colleges have a tough go of it. We're in a very different universe. We built a very strong institution in every way imaginable. Our goal is to become even stronger and to improve the forms of education in and out of the classroom for our students. Here, so we're not doing this because we're worried about our future. We're doing it because we think this is a moment of strength and opportunity for Marist. But it is tough, right? There are many choices out there. Cost is, of course, an issue. We try to make ourselves affordable through targeted financial aid for students with need to the greatest degree possible. But we are mindful that there are headwinds out there, and we need to continue to distinguish ourselves and tell our story better every day so that we can succeed in a challenging landscape.
So in your view, what does it take for a college or university to thrive and be successful nowadays?
Yeah, it's we occupy a sweet spot, which is our greatest strength, in that students and faculty are attracted here because of the emphasis on teaching and small classes. Our students are taught by faculty, not by graduate students, right? That's worked really well for us. Yet we've expanded some very exciting programs. We have one of the best fashion programs in the country, both design and merchandising. Cybersecurity, computer science, accounting, finance, the whole range of academic offerings is available here. And that's grown gradually over time. And again, one of the reasons why we look at ourselves in the mirror and say, this really looks like a small university to the eye.
Well, we're almost halfway through the academic year here. What else is coming down the pipeline at Marist?
Well, one thing we're very excited about is we just opened the Dyson Center, which is a spectacular new 110,000 square foot building that houses our schools of management and social and behavioral sciences. So a third of Marist students spend most of their time in this state-of-the-art facility that has really elevated learning in those disciplines, but yet the building also functions as a second student center. So we're really focused here on, I call it the 168 hours in a week, right? Students are only in class about 12 to 15 hours a week. Those other 150 hours give us immense opportunity to help them grow and develop in other ways. And thinking about building projects not as bricks and mortar, not even just as places for learning in a classroom, but for how students can learn by working together in groups and socializing and relaxing between classes, right? It's what students get out of a 4-year educational experience that makes it so rich. So we'll continue to do things like that. Our strategic plan calls for investing in the academics as we look to adapt what we teach and how we teach it to meet student demand and societal need and the expertise of our faculty. The student experience, as I mentioned before, mental health, physical health, the holistic ways in which we take care of our students while they're here for 4 years. And then expansive community is our third goal, which is introducing Marist to more audiences from further afield and from different backgrounds that in the past haven't looked as much to come to college at Marist. So that's really our vision for the future.
That's Marist College President Kevin Weinman speaking with WAMC Hudson Valley Bureau Chief Jesse King. Marist will officially change its name to Marist University on January 29th. This is the best of our knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Rare wildfires appeared in several Northeast states this autumn amid an historic drought. A University of Massachusetts Amherst analysis of climate data from the National Weather Service shows several communities experienced their driest autumn on record. I spoke with the UMass Climate System Research Center's Dr. Michael Rollins to learn more.
So when we look at the meteorological autumn or fall, which is the months of September, October, and November, Amherst and Hartford both experienced the driest autumn on record. Worcester, Massachusetts, third driest. Quite a few climate sites along the Northeast, particularly closer you get toward the coast, were also record dry. For example, New York Kennedy Airport, Newark, New Jersey, down south, the dryness was actually a bit more severe in New Jersey, and Wilmington, Delaware had a record dry up. Even up north into Bangor, Maine. So it's quite extensive period of dryness. And that dry weather that we've seen recently was exacerbated, if you will, by the extremely dry weather in October.
Now, what about the global weather picture is contributing to this dryness? Why has it been so dry with such a lack of precipitation?
Well, it's interesting. Typically in this time of year, particularly in, let's say, September and into October, our region typically gets precipitation from weakening tropical systems that originate in the Gulf of Mexico and the Western Atlantic that move up from the south and bring precipitation. These are low pressure systems of a tropical origin as opposed to things like nor'easters. And we've really had an absence in recent months of those types of systems. It's almost been like a dry wind out of the west, if you will, off of the land, that's been just an absence of these weather systems that typically bring fall precipitation to the region. A few years ago, I recall there was one period where we had from around July all the way through into December where it was just rain after rain. And this was an interesting fall. Can't really say it's linked to any specific large-scale weather anomaly. It's just one of those years where we just had a bunch of dry weather stacked up upon week upon week.
So, Michael, why do you think it's so important that we study this climate data, and why is this valuable to your research?
Well, one of the reasons why we want to understand and take a closer look at the depth, if you will, of the dryness is, for one thing, water resources. A lot of places, smaller reservoirs and lakes, particularly, as I mentioned, to the south, like in New Jersey and into Delaware, groundwater levels, even in Massachusetts and up further north, up into New England, groundwater levels have dropped quite a bit. They're really particularly low right now. As I mentioned, smaller surface storages like smaller lakes and ponds, reservoirs, the levels have dropped quite a bit over the past couple months. And one of the reasons for that is it was also warmer than normal. Both Hartford and Worcester had their second warmest autumn on record. So with the warmer weather and the lack of precipitation, you get more evaporation from the surface. So water at the surface evaporates. The atmosphere is more thirsty, if you will. So we really want to understand how dry it was so we can better conserve water. So a lot of agencies are encouraging folks to conserve right now. Don't wash your car quite as often, you know, check for leaks in your homes and try to do your best to conserve our resources, because we don't know how much longer this dry weather will continue. We're running quite big deficits of precipitation right now, upwards of, for the year, up to places 8 to 10 inches shy of what's normal. So that's why it's really important to understand how dry it's been, and put that in a perspective of our water resources. Now, as I mentioned, we really don't expect in years to come that this dryness will turn into long-term trends like out in the western U.S. But it has been quite severe, and the drought monitoring agencies like the U.S. Department of Agriculture, a lot of places in the region are running moderate to severe drought right now for the surface conditions.
That's Michael Rollins of the UMass Climate System Research Center. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1784. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.